time to take a listen to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Onirua. Last Saturday, Jan Scott talked to weedbuster Gary Wilton, the author of a book on Colin McCann, Gordon Brown, dog group organisers Anne Carr and Barbara Wilkinson, anti-cell phone tower campaigner Stephanie Honeychurch, and rat hunter Sue Fitchett.
Welcome Gary Wilton to the show. Welcome, Gary.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks for asking me around.
It's a pleasure. Now, before we get on to the success of the Weed Busters and the moss plant, how did you get into this business?
How did I get into this business? Well, I came to Waiheke about 8 years ago. I was working for Auckland City Council and their communications team in the middle of town. And usual story, came to Waiheke, liked the look of it. What attracted me to Waiheke was the walking tracks. I do a lot of running off-road, and this is the best network of walking tracks in a small area anywhere in New Zealand, I think. And the chance to live on Waiheke and work in the middle of town is pretty attractive to most of us who have to work in the middle of town. So came out of here and was here for 2 or 3 years and really enjoyed it, knew how to work council. This job came up. Interestingly, Patrick Thorpe had been doing it for about 5 years, and they advertised, and I saw the advert in the Gulf News, and probably like about half the island, I thought, I love that job. What a fantastic job. But of course, I didn't have any horticultural background. It said horticultural knowledge necessary. So I thought, oh, well, you know, one of those things, it's not going to be. And they employed somebody who came up from Wellington with his whole family, and he lasted 3 weeks. And he said, too much paperwork. And I knew after 5 years at that point with council, if there was one thing that I could do, it was council paperwork. And I hoped that I could learn the rest. So I made a call inside council and said, look, I'm passionate about the place. I know the tracks inside out. I think I can learn the rest. How about giving me a go? And they said, well, come along for interview. And somehow I turned out to be the best candidate.
That's great, and it's obviously good for us as well. Judging by your accent, you've come a bit further than Wellington.
Yeah. I grew up in the Peak District in Derbyshire, near Sheffield, north of England. Went to Scotland to university and stayed there for 13 years. Got a little bit bored in the samey, and I met a couple of New Zealanders, and they told me that New Zealand was like Scotland with hills and beaches at the bottom of them, which sounded like a pretty good deal. So I packed my backpack and my mountain bike and came over on a holiday visa to see if I liked it and I could get a job. Got a job within about 3 months, liked it immediately, got a job within 3 months, met my to-be wife at my first interview at council, and here I am 10 years later with 2 kids, best job in the world. Best island in the world.
Absolutely, I agree with you on that one. Just tell us a little bit about what your job involves.
Oh, it's pretty broad ranging. It covers basically the key parts are contract management. So we have a contract with City Park Services on the island to maintain all of the parks across the Hauraki Gulf. On Waiheke, we've got something like 200 pieces of land that we treat as park. Around about 100 of those are in common usage and maintained every week. That's one of the key parts. Second part is probably the customer interface. So if somebody has an issue with park or road verge on Waiheke, then I'm the first point of contact, and I'll deal with those customer queries, probably deal with about 20 of those a week, something like that. Then there's the development of the network, particularly the walkway network. We've got the playgrounds, obviously the weed side of things, and then one of the things which I've tried to push really hard is those volunteer partnerships on the island, and working in alongside the people who want to spend their time improving the public land near where they live or the particular parts that they like around the island. And that's one of the things that we've been really successful with, I think, over the last 5 years.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of people on the island who are really keen to keep the weeds away and to foster our native plants on the island. That must be a bonus for you.
Yeah. The ARC tell us that Waiheke is the second weediest island in the world.
I hope they're just talking about the plants.
Yep. I have to continually put up with the usual range of jokes that we get from people in town whenever you mention Waiheke and virtually anything. But at the end of the day, people know we've got something pretty special here. And it makes my job incredibly easy and incredibly rewarding working with people who feel as passionately as me about the place and are happy to spend their time and often their money keeping the place right and improving it.
I think the attitude of council has changed a bit too, because probably about 20 years ago now, there was a piece in the Gulf News about an invasive plant that I had virtually covered my section, and I thought it was very pretty, a pretty bush. It had sort of like, I suppose I used to call it a sweet pea bush. It had little tiny purpley-pink flowers on it. Mm-hmm. I've still got quite a few of those on there. And when I rang council about it, they said, "Where do you live?" And I said, "Rocky Bay." And they said, "Oh, Rocky Bay, we've given up on that." So I don't know whether they've given up on Rocky Bay or not. I suspect not, because I certainly haven't seen any moss plant around for a while. And I had some on my section at one stage. And I must give credit to the university kids that come over once a year. And I think they're from the university. And they come over and identify properties that have got things on, and Mark put a blue tag or whatever on them. And I've had the same girl come 2 years in a row now, and they're very pleasant. They do a great job, and obviously pass on the info to you guys. I don't know whether it's a volunteer thing or they're contracted, but they do a great job.
Great.
Yeah. Now, you've really got to take credit, you and Jeanette Reeve, for the Weed Busters. They've been a phenomenal group. I commute, and occasionally I see you guys down on the wharf dressed in mad outfits and promoting the extermination of a particular weed, and it's obviously paid dividends.
Yeah, Jeanette is a great organiser. She's a fantastic person for making things happen on the island. And a real asset to Waiheke. What we've done with Weed Busters is really just pull together all the people who are involved in weed control on the island and agreed one plan and one set of priorities, and that we'd all work towards it. And rather than working in sort of vaguely similar directions with a nod to each other, we're all working in one direction. And what that means for places like Rocky Bay is that rather than be overwhelmed by the sheer number, range and volume of weeds on Waiheke, we're picking off our targets. So we've got two main strategies. One is to protect and extend the precious weed-free areas that we've got, and really they're around the forest and bird reserve at Maitiatia and the whole valley in Maitiatia, and we've looked to try and manage all of that valley from the Morrow Hall down to the wharf for weeds, whether that be council land, forest and bird land, private land. And I think we've done a pretty good job there, and you're hard pushed to see any significant weed infestations, particularly on the public land down there. And that can be quite hard where you've got council land owned by three or four different parts of council, and there's land around, say, the Ofanaki treatment plant, which is managed ostensibly by somebody in town who's responsible for sewage systems, and that guy isn't the remotest bit worried about the fact that there might be some nasty weeds in one corner of that huge piece of land. So we have to do a bit of sweet talking and charming and working the system, which hopefully is something that I've learned over the years. Likewise with the Maitiatia Waitemata infrastructure land, that's not a reserve at the moment, so not something I can directly control, but we know who is looking after it, and we can influence it, and we've got money from town out in addition to the parks budget spent on weed control down there. The other precious area is obviously Fokinafa, and I think Rocky Bay's benefited from the work that Andy Spence has done at Fokinafa over the years, and obviously then looking to push out the weed-free, weed-control areas there. We're now prioritising Rangahua and the sports park, and putting $50,000 a year just into Onatangi Sports Park on weed control. That's the size of the problem there. And on the island, we reckon we're spending about $500,000 a year on weed control on Waiheke between the different players. And that's not including everybody who gets the landscapers in to fix their lifestyle property, which would be probably another $1 million on top of that.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. There is one area in Rocky Bay where your weed eradication has worked rather too well, and that's along Pūtikawa Avenue where that bank was sprayed a few years ago, and it's now slipped because there's nothing to hold the bank. And the comment has been made in Rocky Bay that if we'd known that was happening, we could have had a working bee to plant something along there that might have held the bank. But, I mean, you can't think of everything at once, I guess, and these things go in stages, don't they?
Yeah, and we do live and learn. I mean, I wasn't directly involved in that project, and I do know that there was a specific outbreak of a weed, which is that was the only place it was found on the island, so it was maybe necessary to be particularly harsh there. One thing I've become aware of in my sort of steep learning curve over the last 5 years is slips, and we're holding our breath really for this winter, because what we find is when we have a really dry summer, the ground cracks up, breaks the roots that are holding the soil on the cliffs, and then if we get a really wet winter and the ground gets really wet and heavy, it will just pull that soil away. Down at Oripu by the wharf about 2 years ago, I saw a pretty horrendous slip where an area the size of a tennis court slipped about 30 metres down the bank and left a cliff about 2 metres in front of somebody's deck. Those people had cleared the entire area of weeds in one go the year before. So our general rule now is where it's a steep bank or a cliff, we'll look to clear no more than 10, maybe 20% of the area each year, and gradually transfer it from weeds to natives. Just don't clear the whole bank at once, because it's the roots that hold it together, and the weed roots do just as good a job as the native roots. So we do a gradual transition. We'll clear circles in there, put natives in, and then let those get established, and then do more circles next year and more circles until over about 10 years we've done the whole lot.
It sounds like a good program. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The hot water, is it the steam killing process for weeds? You're still using that process?
No. My understanding is that we've been through a bit of a journey in terms of use of herbicide on Waiheke. People will feel strongly about that either way. Council's approach, led by the community board over the past few years, has been to minimise our use of herbicide across the island as a whole, and not to encourage private individuals to spray unless they've got the proper certification. Done badly, it can be a real bad thing. Done well, it can be the most effective way of dealing with some pretty nasty plants. What we do on the roadside is we use very little herbicide in the roadside. We use a little bit on pampas plants because it's pretty much the only feasible way of killing a large number of pampas plants in the road verge. But other than that, we spray the grass, the kaikuya grass that grows into the tarmac where there's no curb and would just rip up the tarmac over time, with a product called BioSafe, which is made from palm oil. That's not without its issues, whether it be health, cost, or sustainability of palm oil plantations, but that's where we are at the moment. I'd love somebody to come up with a better technique. I know they did hot water spraying at one point, but it just wasn't economically or practically feasible, I understand.
And of course, with quite a few of these invasive plants, the only way to really get rid of them is to dig them out, isn't it?
Yeah. We've been hitting the weeds seriously, I think it's fair to say, from the council side of things, for the last 10 years now. And our team leader with City Parks on the weed team has an incredible amount of patience and passion for turning areas around, and he's learned an incredible amount, and they've built up a great deal of knowledge. And because we say to them, we only use Roundup effectively, which are of the herbicides is one of the least controversial, I guess is the way of putting it. we pretty much restrict them to Roundup, whereas other councils around the city and the country will use all sorts of things. So they've had to be inventive, test methods, try all different things. And we think that we, rather than hitting things with a sledgehammer, hit them with the sniper's rifle. So we do dig up on occasion. But we also have ways of, you know, cutting and pasting or injecting or spraying with a minimal amount at a minimum dilution, that sort
of
thing.
What I was thinking of in particular was asparagus fern. That sort of has quite a root system, and you can spray it and it'll dry off, but it'll spring back again because it. And gorse, I think, is another, isn't mm-hmm. it? You can mm-hmm. burn it and it still comes back because the root system is so good.
Yeah, I mean, every weed has the best. There's a best practice way of dealing to every weed, really, and they're all different. I mean, gorse, we pretty much don't deal to it. The best thing really is to plant around it and shade it out over a number of years because it's just so hard to beat. And that's what you have to do with weeds. You've got to identify the wars that you can win, the battles that you can win, rather than try and beat the whole lot all at once. And that's why we concentrate particularly on moth plant and moth plants in pod at the moment. That is a war that we can win, and we do feel like we are winning it. As well as looking after our most precious areas, we agreed with Weedbusters that we would concentrate on the most dangerous weeds. And the ARC, the biosecurity people at the ARC, identify those for us. And I think we call it a containment plant, moth plant. And the other one on the island is Rhamnus evergreen buckthorn. Moth plant is the one that we ask the public to help with. It's easy to spot when the pods are there, and it's quite easy to deal with.
Is there an education program for people to let them know what doesn't work on Waiheke? The reason I ask that question is that my next door neighbour from many years ago came up from the South Island, and he planted some wattles on his section because in the South Island, you know, they were slow growing and they were a great tree, mm-hmm. whereas here they just go mad. And that's possibly how we get some of these plants that people in their ignorance plant, not realising just how prolific they will grow on the island.
Things do grow really well here, don't they?
They do.
Unless you're trying to grow vegetables on a clay section, I guess. but the weeds do grow incredibly well. We offer a service between myself and Darren Jomgul, who's the ARC biosecurity officer on the island, that basically if you ring us up and you want some advice, we'll come out and talk you through your section, particularly on weed control, but also on revegetation with native plants, because we recognise it's very easy to launch in with the best will in the world and loads of energy and clear a section, and then if you clear a section, the first thing that will happen is it will grow back in worse weeds.
Hmm. Is there a connection between your department and, say, the planning division of council, so that if somebody goes for a building consent to build a new house on a section, and some of those sections, they've got to have a planning plan as well, that you can give them some information at that point as to what is appropriate and what isn't?
If you are doing major earthworks or vegetation removal on a section for building, then you're required to have a mitigation plan to replace the vegetation. So I guess that's one way that we catch that. We're lucky on Waiheke that we're small enough that the team within council do know each other, and we can say, hey, I was out at this site and this person looks like they need some help. Would you be able to go out there? And we've got enough resource that we can actually get out and help people. It's the sort of thing where the scale that we are in Waiheke works for us, and in town you just couldn't do that.
Absolutely. Well, there's an article in the marketplace this week that I encourage everyone to read about. It's headed Island Set Example Over a Moth Plant, and the model on Waiheke for eradicating the moth plant has now been picked up by the Auckland Regional Council as a model for others to use. That's a huge accolade for you and your team, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. And believe it or not, we do have quite a good budget for weed control on Waiheke. And everybody who's got honeysuckle and gorse and everything in the road verge outside their house will be rolling about, clutching their stomach and laughing or screaming right now. But we are able to target it at those worst things, and we do feel like this is one we're winning. we are required by law, as all private property owners are, to remove moth plant and rhamnus because it's classified as at that level by the ARC. It's classified at that level, one, because it's dangerous, but also because it is a winnable battle. There are other things that, like honeysuckle, that are climbing over everything and are smothering our native plants, but it's so widespread and so hard to deal with that it's just not a winnable war, and it's not worth making it a priority. Mm. We'd have to be spending $5 million a year to get on top of honeysuckle, potentially. So the biosecurity people who know far more than me about these things have identified moth plant as a winnable war on Waiheke, not winnable in Auckland. It's gone too far in Auckland. It's just too much out. It's out there everywhere. And, yeah, just not winnable. Auckland's too big a place. There are too many out of control, unmanaged places.
Which means we have to keep vigilant because the seeds could come over here on the air or be dropped by birds or whatever.
Yeah, the moth plant seeds are wind blown when the pods, which look a bit like chocos, they're sort of pear shaped for those who don't know that. I think people generally know them. If you've got something that looks like a pear or a choco growing in a vine in your garden and it's in pods right now, it's moth plant basically. And when they burst open, there are up to 10,000 wind blown seeds in there. They tend to drop on the ground in the local area immediately, and if you have pods that burst on your property over 2 or 3 years, you will just have a blanket of vines across the ground growing over everything, and that's when it gets really bad and it will smother the native plants and kill them.
Right. Do you have a team of volunteers at all?
We have good backup from the volunteers who are working around the island, particularly who are working with Forest and Bird or in the volunteer projects like Mackenzie, Newton, down at Oripu, etc. And I tend to think that we have a great army of willing workers who will turn out when there is a particular need on Waiheke, which is fantastic. But a lot of the work on public lands done by council and city parks, we think we're on top of moth plant on public land now after the last 3 or 4 years. We've got more than 200 sites that we have recorded, and we'll go out to them in January before they pod every year and deal to it. And if you catch it before it pods, it's you know, it's a 5-minute job to cut the vines.
Right. Do you have, if somebody's concerned about possible invasive plants on their own section, is there somebody they can ring for advice?
Yeah. It's interesting. Before I was in this job, I used to think of weeds as little annoying plants that grew around the edge of the garden bed. And then that was introduced to this term, noxious weeds, which sort of historically we've used to talk about the weeds that will really invade and run out of control. And then I guess moth plant is sort of the obnoxious weed that we're concentrating on the most. But if you're looking to turn your section or your garden round from weedy, or usually most gardens are, say, half mown, and then there's a bit at the bottom of the garden that you just don't get into, and it's where you've thrown your stuff over the years and the weeds grow through it and it's out of control, we can come out and give you some advice, particularly with moth plant. If people want to call me, so that's Gary Wilton on 5923 on the island. Or general weed queries, they can call Darren Drumgool, who's our biosecurity officer, and she's on the ARC number, that's 366-2000, and ask for biosecurity on Waiheke or Darren Drumgool on Waiheke.
That's great. Thank you very much for coming in, Gary. That's been most informative.
No problem.
It is now my pleasure to introduce Gordon Brown. Gordon's just written a book about probably our most well-known artist, Colin McCann. Gordon, I understand that you knew Colin rather well.
Yes, I knew him briefly as a student in Christchurch, and then better when I came up in 1964 to librarian at the Elam School of Art.
So did you study together?
No. There's quite a gap.
Because you are an artist, aren't you?
Well, I think I have to say what wasn't an artist.
Okay, so whereabouts did you train?
Well, I had I went to Wellington Tech. This was before it became, you know, proper polytechs and things like that. But that they had a very good art school there, and one got a pretty good basic training there. When I went to Christchurch to the Canterbury School of Art, one didn't have nearly as good a training as one got at the Tech. But one, you know, if you wanted jobs, you had to have that piece of paper when you graduate. Yeah.
You're widely thought of as an art historian of note, and has that really become more of an interest than painting itself?
Not so much a change of interest in painting, but a change of interest of working with paintings instead of producing them. One started writing about them. It really started off with when I came up to Auckland. The art galleries were beginning to get concerned about the fact there was no art critic on the newspapers, and I think I was about the 30th person asked. But because I was working at Elam, I had the advantage of being always, you know, on a known spot, and easily got on the telephone. So this was for the Auckland Star, and initially they wanted a panel. You know, one of the problems in New Zealand, you solve every problem by having a panel. But what happened, the people slowly drifted away, and I was left to doing it by myself. But when I went to work at the Auckland Art Gallery, I had to occasionally find some other person to do the crits if the show was at the Auckland Art Gallery.
So. Right. Now, for a novice like me, what is involved in being an art historian?
What's involved in being an art historian? Well, it means the history you're writing is about... simply about some form of art.
Is it something that you've got to study?
That's only become recent. When I went to Canterbury and we had art history, the art history was about a level of standard four, and you know, appallingly bad level. So you certainly didn't learn any of the professional things one would expect to learn.
Yes, because it's now something you can major in at university.
Yes. It's things. In Auckland, Peter Tomery, when he left the Art Gallery, went to the university and set up an art history chair, whatever I like to call it, but he wanted it so it can be not just a teaching arts to students, but on a broader a basis. So which finally sort of came about that it became a separate chair from the or department from the art school.
Right, and it's a very wide ranging subject, isn't it?
Yes,
across a wide range of genres and,
yes,
and
yeah.
art.
Well, it's also been in recent years been widening into various niche subjects. You know, the old German art historians, which were the mainstay of early courses in art history, is, you know, completely changed now. So you have all sorts of ranges of approaches available to the art historian.
Mm. Yes. Now, with your contact with Colin McCann, at what period of his painting career was he at that point when you met him?
Well, when I first met him, he was doing what is roughly called the Cubist paintings, just when he was finishing the what's called the early religious paintings of the late 40s, early 50s. One of the paintings he was doing when I first met him was on building bridges, which was on three panels, and he'd although I didn't know this to later, he had just been over to Sydney and to Melbourne in Australia to pick up hints from being able to look at old master paintings, which Melbourne being the nearest city to have a number of good old master paintings. But he also met a woman who gave him lessons, which sounds like they were mainly talking about things rather than actually, you know, doing anything on with the brush.
So was he taught, or was he self-taught?
No. He spent several years. Well, some of them were broken years, because this was at the end of the Depression period, you know, when money was very short. So he went to the Dunedin Art School, had a very good teacher there named Field, who was quite a notable artist in his own right. And Colin saw him as a sort of the epitome of what a good artist, art teacher produced. And I think it affected him right through to when he started doing lecturing in art at the Elam School of Art.
I think from my own personal observation, the first time I became aware of Colin McCann was when we as a country gave Sydney his I Am, I think it was, painting to celebrate, was it their bicentenary?
Yes, it's Victory Over Death 2, it's called.
Okay.
Yes, it was given to the national. Well, at that time, the collection of the National Gallery of Australia, because the gallery was still being planned and built at the time it was actually given, it was shown at the opening of the gallery, which wasn't that much later. And had quite an impression on some of the artists, particularly when they saw it besides Pollock and other big names in the history of painting.
It was probably quite a brave thing for our government to do, actually, to give a contemporary piece of art rather than a Goldie or something of that sort.
No, I think it was. I think there was some discussion first about it. So it wasn't completely a blind gift to Australia.
Right. And of course, Colin McCann has now become probably our most notable contemporary artist and most sought after. Certainly most expensive, I think. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, it's been a long haul before that really occurred. But this is where an artist sticks with his guns, you know, on what he wants to do. And McCann had this dedication of trying to get ideas across.
He wasn't a populist artist, was he?
No. That's why it took so long for him to gain sort of recognition. But he was lucky that he had a few close supporters quite early on, including Charles Brash, who was the editor of the magazine Landfall. There were several works illustrated in Landfall quite early on.
You're listening to Island Life. I'm Jan Scott, and I'm in conversation with Gordon Brown, who's written a book called Towards a Promised Land on the life and art of Colin McCann. Now, Gordon, this book is going to be launched at Tivoli on Tuesday night?
No. It's been...
On the 13th of April.
That's just for a signing.
Oh, okay.
It was launched on the, I think the 10th of March.
Right. Yes. Right. So you'll be there this coming Tuesday at Tivoli between 6 and 7 to sign copies of the book.
Anyone who wants your book signed.
Excellent. Yeah. Now, what prompted you to write the book?
Well, it was partly one had some existing essays or notes for what they call floor talks, you know, which is where people go around the art gallery, you know, and you talk about various paintings or maybe it's a special exhibition that's on, and of course that they have to be turned into an essay. But one of the real problems in New Zealand is that so often you've got to produce an essay in super fast time, which doesn't give you the time to really tidy the things up. So doing the book gave one the chance to reassess some of the essays and, you know, make some of the things one had said a bit more clearer.
Is it something you'd had in your mind for a while to do?
Yes, because although quite a few, there are some original essays which haven't appeared anywhere else. One of the longest ones on McCann's involvement in live theatre, which a lot of people didn't know about.
How was he involved in live theatre?
Well, he, right from the early days when he was at the Dunedin School of Art, he met a senior student, Rodney Kennedy, who was very keen on drama, and they got together. They had a couple of rooms in one of the repertory society halls, where they could do all the preparation for the scenery, which they designed, and they got quite a reputation for doing this. And this of course was still in the depression days, where, you know, money was very tight, so you had to be quite skillful and you using, you know, cheap materials to look as though they're rich, and did the job. Later, when he came up to Auckland, he formed with Frank Sargentson and Chris Cathcart, initially to do Frank Sargentson's plays, because the first one was very successful, they decided to form a little group. They, on the main, used the big hall, one of the big halls, galleries in the art gallery, and some support from the Friends of the art gallery, produced New Zealand plays, and the emphasis was on New Zealand plays. But he did do outside that. For example, one of the ones he really enjoyed doing the scenery for was one of Tennessee Williams' plays, The Glass Menagerie, which he always regarded as one of his real excesses. But it had the problem is that, you know, this was for a summer tour, so he had to make scenery that could fit into a number of places of varying size. So you had it so that could be, you know, one side and the other side could be joined or widened to allow for the scenery to fit in halls.
So have any of those scenery flats survived?
I doubt it, because fairly flimsy materials. Some of that was simply curtains, because this was part of the play that you sometimes saw someone in a room, in another room, and you saw it through like a gauze curtain.
And of course, those scenery flats are reused, aren't they? They're painted over and used again. So.
Yeah. Well, with these ones, because they had that sort of, they had to have this flexibility. They probably wouldn't be able to use that much again. Although you could probably break down some of the actual wood and stuff.
It might be interesting if some of the local companies had a look in the back of their halls and community halls and think they might find a treasure there.
Yes.
And so you decided to write this book. How long did it take you to do?
Oh, it took quite a long time, because I managed to break my right hand.
Oh.
And, on the computer keyboard with left hand, which is, I'm a two-finger typist. So one could use one's thumb, you know, for the it's just the stops, you know, all the spaces between words and that. One made quite a few mistakes.
And so, how long did it take you to write?
Hmm?
How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, it's probably about three years. But I mean, one was also doing other things at the same time. Yeah.
So, have you got another project in mind?
Well, the project I have got in mind is to complete a series of exhibitions I did with the Arts Council on painting in New Zealand, which was never completed. There was a change in the Arts Council, and one was just one of the victims of, you know, this change.
That sounds like an enormous project. Is it going to be narrowed down to a particular genre, or is it across the board?
The original one were exhibitions, you know, so you had to find lots of paintings that could be borrowed, you know, for exhibitions and to the country. But that part of it, you know, in the catalogue, painters can be dropped, and they become, hopefully, if we can refine some of them.
Mm.
Although the idea was to have mainly paintings that came from public galleries, so that, which was part of the Arts Council's input in the exhibition, so that hopefully one would use a lot of those paintings again, but the whole emphasis now is away from black and white illustrations to colour illustrations, so one has to do a lot of hunting to find out what's happened to some of these paintings.
So have you got a timeline for the project?
No, not at the stage. No, it's more just an idea which one's sort of thinking about seriously of doing.
Sounds like it's going to keep you busy. In the meantime, of course, you've got this wonderful book out on Colin McCann. Are there any other books on Colin? Or I'd have thought there'd have been quite a library of them.
Oh, yes. Well, there's the one I produced, which is called Colin McCann Artist. But you've got you've got, just trying to think of his name, who's this person that done several aspects of McCarr.
So you have done a book on him before?
Yes.
Okay. Is that still in print and still available?
No, it's been out of print for a long time.
But I guess people could get it out of the library.
Yes,
what is it called, Gordon?
It's just called Colin McCarr Artist.
Colin McCarr Artist by Gordon Brand. So you go into the Waiheke Library and ask for that one. Or on Tuesday night, between 6 and 7, go into the Tivoli Bookshop. That's Tuesday the 13th of April. Colin will be there to sign his book, and now the latest book called Towards a Promised Land, on the life and art of Colin McCarr. And we wish you well with that, Gordon. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
It's now my pleasure to introduce Anne Carr and Barbara Wilkinson from the Dog Owners Group. Welcome, Anne and Barbara.
Hi, Jan.
Now, I noticed in the marketplace this week that you've been successful in squeezing some money out of the community board for new equipment for the dog's agility.
Yes, program. They've been very generous to us and gave us the whole grant that we asked for dog agility equipment.
That's brilliant. Now, what exactly is dog agility equipment?
Well, we currently have about $3,000 worth of dog agility equipment that we have raised funds for ourselves. That comprises of, we've got a huge dog tunnel, which was around about $1,000. You can bend it different ways, so the dog doesn't necessarily see all the way through, so you can make it more difficult. We've also got another tunnel, which closes at one end, so the dog's going through a closed tunnel. We start out with it open and build up to that. We've got a dog walk, which is like a ramp that they go up and walk along, come back down again. So it's nothing that dogs don't naturally do in their normal day-to-day being a dog, but it's a bit like jungle gyms for kids. You know, dogs get well-being from being dogs, and one of the things that we do is the weave, which is not a natural thing that a dog would do, but we teach them and they enjoy it, and it's really good socialising for the dogs.
There was a program on television a year or so ago with, that had these things in it, and the owner and the dog would zigzag in and out and then run through a tunnel and jump over a
The Wonder Dog.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we're the Waiheke Wonder Dogs.
The Waiheke Wonder Dogs. What a great idea. And, of course, I guess that you get dogs coming along who need to lose a bit of weight or maybe gain a bit of muscle or whatever, or just for the sheer sociability of it.
That's right, all of those things. And it's really nice for the dog owners. Before I joined the dog owner group, I didn't really know another friend who had a dog, and they're a huge commitment. Now I've got lots of friends with dogs, with the dog owners group, so it's been really wonderful for me socially as well, and it's excellent for the dogs. They need to socialise in order to, you know, be well adjusted, and it's really, really excellent for both.
So this the equipment you've got for them, is that part of the training program as well?
Yes, they start out really, they have to do an obedience course because there are different things that they need to learn in order to be able to do the agility, to be able to run a course with you. Just basic things that we teach in a dog obedience course. Just sit down, wait, come, away, heel, leave, and a recall. So once they can achieve those, then they're ready to do agility. They really need to be 1 year old before they start agility, or if it's a German Shepherd type dog, for example, they take longer to mature, and the bones they need to be about 18 months. So we just try and keep it safe. We're not interested in getting them to jump huge heights because we're careful with their joints and their legs. It's just the discipline of jumping between the poles, and they really enjoy it.
And how did you get involved with it? Is it just as a dog owner, or did you have some other connection?
There was an advertisement for, you know, that's how I became involved. Barbara Wilkinson is the founder, and or one of the founding people, and she ran an advertisement which I answered. They were looking for instructors. I did dog obedience instructing many years ago at Akarana Dog Obedience, and so things haven't changed an awful lot. We still use positive reinforcement as our main means of teaching. So
okay, Barbara, can I ask you to come into the mic? I'll try and get that a bit further out for you, or you could even take it out of there. So how did you come to set up this group?
We set up the group because we were, at the time, we were going for a unrestricted beach for dogs, and this is where it sort of really stemmed from. Through that, people became involved in that, and so it was decided that we needed to form an actual group so that we sort of had the numbers, and that's how it sort of came about. And there's a couple of other people that have been in it from its conception as well. That
there are a lot of dogs on the island, aren't there?
That I believe there's just over 1,000.
That's quite amazing when you consider our population base. Mm. One thing I find quite amusing about dog owners is, or people I know that have got dogs, vaguely my neighbours and things, you tend to know the dog's name rather than the person's name.
Very true. Very
and
true.
And you sort of say, "Oh, that's so and so's owner." You know that's Spot's owner or whatever. Mm. No doubt, with the dogs socialising together, you get to do some of that yourselves as well.
It's great. We do it out at Oni Tangi Sports Park, and it's interesting. We do have a lot of families that are out there with their children during the day, and it's because it is a spectators' sport, really, and they just love it.
How often do you do it?
We're doing the agility once a week, and we will be doing fly ball once a week as well, which is a different thing again.
What day of the week do you do it on, and what time?
Saturday morning we're doing it at 10:30, the agility, and the fly ball we're just trying to organise an evening so that we don't clash with soccer or rugby out at the sports park.
Okay. You could always have the dogs chasing the balls, of course. I'm sure that'd help some of the guys get the balls in the right place. But are you an incorporated society, or are you just an informal group?
We're not.
We're affiliated with North Shore Dog Obedience. We've got, people on our committee that are in the North Shore Dog Obedience, so we're affiliated with them, but we're not an incorporated society.
Is there a charge for the obedience course?
We charge $35 if you are not part of the dog owners group. That entitles you to become part of the dog owners group and 6 obedience lessons.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
It's very good, and that, it's possible because of getting this grant means that we can keep, those fees down.
So how do people contact you? Should they just turn up
at
the park?
They can ring me at home, 372-6362.
That's Anne?
Yes. Or Mary Evans on 372-7836. Either of those phone calls would get...
Or pop down to the sports park on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, it's
10 o'clock.
Sorry, Sunday morning.
Sunday morning.
At 10:30.
At 10:30 on Sunday morning at the sports park. Mm. Okay, now, you get all shapes and sizes of dogs?
We sure do. We've got, I was thinking that the other day, we've got one of just about everything you can imagine. So we've got, and they're all, it's quite interesting that they're all dogs. Basically, they're just all in different shapes and sizes.
Do they all get on? Do you have any problems with them at times?
No, they get on really well. I think, part of the socialising means that they become really well adjusted, and so they learn how to get on with each other.
With your obedience course, is there any training for the owner? as to how they should behave towards the dog and the reactions they should have and that sort of thing.
The training's all around the owner. We speak to the owner and the owner trains the dog at home, basically, because it's an ongoing thing, dog training. It's going to go on through the dog's life. It's just like education for anybody, and they are entitled, really, to training. And so we train the owner, or we teach the owner, and all the dogs do it together, so that's a good distraction for them. So trying to do it under with those distractions going on, that sort of simulates the kind of environment you might get on the beach or when they actually do need to be able to respond. So, and it's, you know, it's repetitive and it's positive reinforce based.
Yes, every now and then you see a letter to the Golf News or an article about a dog that's harassed somebody on a beach or in a park or something of that sort. Or you get bad press for a certain breed of dog. It's been my observation that it's not so much the breed of the dog but the attitude of the owner that makes quite a difference. Would that be fair?
Yes, I don't think people intend to do the wrong thing, but it's just a matter of respecting dogs as a species. They are not humans, and we're both great species, but we have different ways of communicating. So we respect the way the dog would communicate, so not sort of, you know, patting them on top of the head, which they would consider as a threat. And so they've got to try and cope with that if they don't know you. So just touching them under the chin, or actually Cesar Millan says no speak, no touch, no eye contact. So you just basically not putting yourself all over the dog, just allowing it to come and sniff you and until it's sort of ready to be touched under the chin. So there's a lot of things that we do as humans that aren't correct behaviour if you're a dog, and that can lead, that could possibly lead to them responding if they're not used to it. So we try to talk about those sorts of things with people when they come to our group too.
When I was a child, I was taught never to run up to an animal, never run up behind an animal, and if you're approaching a dog, to put your hand down, sort of palm out, so that they can get you, they can sniff you. Is that good advice?
That is really good advice, yes. Other things that people do that they don't intend to is they sort of teach their dog not to come to them. And that can be a problem when they're on the beach by having a disincentive when the dog comes by snapping it onto the lead and taking it away from whatever it was that was exciting it. So we talk about things like that, about managing situations. So before you head off to the beach, taking your lead, taking maybe an extended lead if the dog's not coming, and leaving it on a long leash, or and teaching the dog to come by having a food reward and stepping backwards away from the dog and calling in a high tone that they're tuned into. They're not so tuned into the lower tones, and doing lots of hand signals. And really, hand signals are the key to dog obedience, because humans are so into speech, we tend to think they know what we're saying, but they're actually watching our hands. They're tuned into action or movement. So we talk about those sorts of things, and it's amazing how the dogs progress through the courses.
And they would react to, you know, to your behaviour. If you were agitated and upset, they would react to your behaviour too, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, absolutely.
There was an instance I had a few years ago that I think it's the only time I really felt threatened by dogs, and I was walking along Bella Vista Road in Rocky Bay, and there were three dogs standing ahead of me, a big dog and a smaller one and a little one. And as I walked towards them, I could tell by the big one's demeanour that he was sort of sticking his toes in and backing up slightly, and I thought, this is a problem. So I just carried on very quietly at the same pace, but gradually turned and walked back the other way without looking back, and hoping like heck that they weren't chasing me. But I think if I'd stopped and then turn suddenly and gone, they may well have followed. Yeah. I don't know.
Dog behaviour experts. There are dog behaviour experts available on the island. And Oh, yes. And but we're a voluntary dog owners group of people that have different experience. I think what you did then was the correct thing to do. One of the things that humans do to dogs that they misinterpret is we look them in the eye, just like I'm looking you in the eye right now, which is good manners on my behalf. If you were a dog, it would be very bad manners, and I would be challenging you. And you might feel, you know, that you'd need to take up that challenge. Another thing that you could do if you're walking along like that is if you've got your handbag, you haven't if you're a man, have you? But anyway, if you're holding something, put it between you and the dog. Always put something that you're holding between you and the dog. And, you know, the advice that your mum gave you was the correct advice. Just stand still, look away, just wait until they move away. Turn around and go the other way. If you're feeling threatened, they are going to feel that. So turn around and go the other way. Don't push it.
Right. Now, the agility equipment that you've got, is that suitable for dogs of all sizes and ages?
Yes, we, as I was saying, we start the dogs at 1 year of age, although we do start dogs younger than that, but we don't put them over jumps. We just put them between the poles, and they might like to run through the tunnels. It's a lot of fun for them. But as a rule of thumb, we start them around 1 year, 1 year of age. And we don't actually have our jumps up high. We just keep our jumps reasonably low because we are respecting our pets, and we just want them to, you know, not have any ailments. And we don't want to push them, but, you know, they can jump high, and they love to jump high. But we don't do that often.
Right.
We're looking.
Sounds like a great group to belong to if you are a dog owner, both for the owner and the dog from a social point of view. And so if anybody's interested in getting involved with the dog owners group, they meet on a Sunday at 10:30 down at the sports park. And you can contact Anne Carr on 372-6362. Thank you very much, Anne and Barbara, for coming in, and good luck with that.
Thank you, Jan.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island. Art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Ocean View Road, Oniroa.
It is my pleasure to welcome Stephanie Honeychurch along this morning. Stephanie is involved with the campaign to stop the Surfdale Bowling Club erecting the Vodafone Tower. So we've just asked her along to give us an update on progress.
Hi, Jan. Thank you for inviting me. What would you like to know?
Well, this campaign's been going for a wee while now, hasn't it?
It's about 20 months, actually. We've been fighting very hard. Now it's the last ditch because Vodafone have actually begun construction at the club. We've been asking for an extension. We'd like a public debate to be held. We think people should be informed. However, Vodafone has refused. I think it's also important that people in Surfdale realise that the bowling club not only invited Vodafone to the club, they've also invited Telecom to pay rent there as well. And the Telecom tower will be very large. It will be a lamppost and a half outside the club, and it will take up a whole shed within the club compound. And unfortunately, seeing we will have Vodafone there, and then Telecom have already, you know, they've got the applied for consent, probably 2 degrees will come along too. That's how it works.
How big is the Vodafone tower?
It's going to be two masts and two electronic cabinets and a microwave dish, so it will be quite large.
Right. So I think one of the things I've wondered is why pick on the bowling club when there's one just down the road and around the corner on the building that Island Times?
That's a good question. Now, it began as pure NIMBYism. Nobody in Surfdale knew anything about the bowling club's financial dealings until it was broken in the Gulf News by a neighbour of the club. The Toyers, who are actually members of the club also, they knew nothing about it until they were at home one day and saw men in unmarked white cars waiting for them to leave. And when the Toyas left, Mrs. Toya came back 10 minutes later and the men were in her driveway. Now, that was actually... they were from Telecom, not that they let on. The Vodafone application had already been approved. So that's how it all began.
So really, is your opposition to this is the size of it rather than the fact that it's a telephone tower?
No, it's the health effects that we're concerned about, because we do know that there is legitimate, bona fide, peer-reviewed research showing harm. As well as the on-the-ground evidence across the world, there are a lot of cancer clusters. Governments don't want to know about them. You know, as with the cigarette industry, they're going to hang out as long as possible, you know, get that revenue in as long as they can.
So what about the tower, the tower that's on the Island Time building, the aerial that's up there?
Well, we didn't know about that. That is Vodafone already. Now, I think that that's a 2G tower. The new towers are what they call 3G technology, and it's of great concern for everyone in New Zealand, really, because the 2G towers could be 11 kilometres from a phone and work. But the 3G towers have to go every 800 metres across suburban New Zealand, and that's going to involve an awful lot of people when you think that there are now three telcos each wanting to put up their meter every 800 metres. Their phone mast every 800 metres, that's rather a lot.
One would have thought that 3G's would have a wider coverage than 2G's, or am I thick here?
No, that the phone masts have to be more of them closer together. And it's actually a bit of a luxury item, really. It's only so that cell phones can be used more like a computer, so that you can watch a movie on your cell phone. It's not
so
to do with coverage.
If the bowling club was going down the track of having a 2G one, like the one that's on the Island Time, would you still be in opposition to that?
Yes, we would, really, because we want the law to be changed. We've got one of the most permissive laws in the world around phone mast sighting. In direct opposition, in September 2008, the European Parliament voted 522-16 to change the laws around phone mast sighting. They decided to go with the recommendations of the 2007 Bio-Initiative Report, which is a compilation of over 1,500 medical researchers.
So basically the concern is sort of the radioactivity, if you like, from them.
It is. It's the emissions, yes.
Is it? I remember when microwaves first came out, and there was a big worry about people getting zapped that it being bad for the health, and perhaps those early ones were, but the modern ones have been refined and are much better. Does that not work with a cell phone tower?
Well, cell phone towers are microwave energy as well. The guidelines only refer to the cooking properties, the thermal properties, and we know we're not going to be cooked from a phone mast. A microwave oven you can turn off. It's a personal choice. You wouldn't sleep your baby within feet of a microwave oven.
The other argument, of course, is also about the use of cell phones, how bad for the health that can be. We're not outlawing cell phones.
I don't own one myself, but once again, it's a personal choice. And there does actually, the evidence is emerging that there could be risks from cell phones also. They've been linked with male infertility and quite a number of things, actually. Mm.
Yeah, that's right. So it's probably the cell phone that should be targeted rather than the aerial that gets to the cell phone.
Well, we don't actually want to abolish cell phones, but we do think that there should be more caution. We should be applying the precautionary principle to sighting phone masts and our use of cell phones, because it is new technology, and there are many illnesses, especially cancer. A tumour takes a very long time to develop, usually at least 10 years, 20. You know, it will be a long time before we know the full effects, and yet the evidence is starting to emerge. Just yesterday I read about a new cancer cluster, this time in a village called Buckler, in Cornwall, and there are 75 houses there. And the inhabitants are saying that more than 50% of them are ill. They blame a phone mast that was installed there 2 years ago. There's been 10 cases of cancer. And there's the villagers are complaining about all the usual things that seem to be associated with living close to a phone mast: headache, tinnitus, sleep disorders and depression, as well as cancer, skin conditions. There are a whole raft of illnesses that appear to be associated with the emissions.
Quite a few years ago, there was some controversy about those very large power pylons that are throughout Auckland City. And my in-laws had a house right next door to one of those massive, great things. And there was concern that they were... damaged the health. However, both my in-laws lived into their 90s, so maybe some people haven't got an immunity to them all, haven't they?
That's very possible. Pylons are definitely associated with childhood leukaemia, though that cannot be denied any longer, although they tried for a long time. But it seems that just like people with red hair are more sensitive to UV damage, it does seem that some people are more sensitive. And there is a condition called electrohypersensitivity, which affects from 2 to 4% of the population. It's recognised by our government.
Okay, so whereabouts is your campaign up to now?
Well, we're still... It may be futile, but we can't give up yet. We're doing our best to persuade Vodafone to put it on hold.
Have you got any legal or political actions you can take?
We've tried just about everything, all the legal avenues. We've been treated quite badly, actually. It seems to arouse an awful lot of hostility in lots of people. They think we want to deprive them of their cell phones, I think.
So have you got a lot of support from people other than Surfdale residents?
Yes, we do seem to. And in fact, every time somebody writes in the local papers opposing us, we seem to get more support than ever. We get quite a few people ringing in, you know, what can they do?
Because there are towers elsewhere on the island, aren't there? There's one in Ostend, and because there's one down at Matete.
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't seen the Ostend residents jump up and down about the one that's there, but maybe that's because it's been there for a wee while and they didn't have a chance to complain about it or to...
Yes, you see, people haven't
protested about it.
Told, and the way the law is now, since the passing of the National Environmental Standards Act, the telcos can now erect their phone masts on any public infrastructure whatsoever, like a lamppost or a hospital or a school, and they don't have to give notification, which seems pretty unfair. I mean, the rest of us have to go through all sorts of hoops to add a few centimetres to our decks, don't we?
Well, it's interesting that they can do that too. I mean, if it's a public building like a hospital, if it's got medical repercussions, that seems quite extraordinary.
Well,
that
I think that might be because our government is advised by such people as Dr. David Black, who works for Transpower and Vodafone and Telecom. To me, I think it's scandalous. There has been petitions, not just from Waiheke, but other parts of the country, asking that the vested agents, people of vested interest, be removed from the interagency committee. Our government has refused. They've also refused to apply the precautionary principle. You know, they've said that, Chris Orkinvall, a National Party member, we asked that schools be protected from, you know, having phone masts put near them, and he said it's not commercially feasible.
It all boils down to money, by the
sound of it. It's all about money, from the bowling club right up to the government, unfortunately.
Well, that's the way things go, I'm afraid, sometimes in this day and age, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Well, good luck with your campaign, Stephanie, and thank you for coming in and giving us this update.
Thank you, Jean. Bye.
And it's my pleasure to say hello to Sue Fitchett. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Jean.
Welcome. and which has been saying Sue's been on the island for 24 years. So, yeah, I thought she'd been around for a while. You don't look any older, though.
No, you've no feeling.
Don't we all? So you're involved with Forest and Bird, and they've had quite a successful campaign to rid the island of rats. I understand they're doing really well getting down that track.
Well, we'd like to think so, but we won't get any further down that track unless we try to engage and bring on the whole of the island in that job of trying to especially reduce the numbers of ship rats.
Ah, yes. How would you do that? I suppose the only thing you could do really is to send a flyer out to all the boat clubs around Auckland and generally say, you know, be careful you don't bring anything ashore. But then, you know, yachties are usually fairly careful about things like that. But who knows whether you've got one on board and it leaps over and swims ashore.
Well, we've already got our own population of breeding ship rats. So, yeah. Interestingly enough, the ship rats breed more prolifically from Hamilton northward. And the ARC, in the form of Mike Lee, wants to release billbirds again to Waiheke. And billbirds disappeared from Hamilton North in the North Island, largely because ship rats breed very well in the warmer climates. They have more than one litter a year. And they're the ones that do very well at climbing. And they're the ones with the very long tails that we see walk along our phone lines or see up in, or have in our ceiling. And they do the biggest predation on nests. I mean, we do have other animal pests on Waiheke. We have a few stoats. We're lucky we don't have any possums. But the ship rats do the most damage. And Forest and Bird is supporting the ARC Billbird Release Project by, in the next couple of weeks, on April the 24th, supporting and organising a public workshop on pest eradication. And we're calling it Finding the Best Way Forward in Pest Control, and trying to bring on both private and public expertise in pest control using a variety of methods. So people, if they wanted to engage and really get the island, especially shipwreck, free, to come along and learn the method that they could live with, that they could use in their own property.
So whereabouts do people get bait stations and bait from?
Well, they can get bait stations from their local hardware shop, like Placemakers. Forest and Bird does sell one type of bait at the market, at our stall at the market, and that's very reasonable. And so that bait can be placed in safe bait stations on people's property.
Remember, the council used to provide bait too. Do they not do that anymore?
No, not that I know of. No. We also, there are other ways of getting bait, different kinds of bait, and that's what we hope to indicate to the public, that you know, there are various types of methods on the island or can be obtained on the island, and we're just really interested in people having a discussion and deciding on what they can do and their values on their property.
Now, when is the meeting you were talking about, 24th?
The workshop is going to be Saturday the 24th. It's going to be between 1 and 4, and it'll involve presentations, including we're having Ark in the Park people coming over from Waitakere, and Judy Woodcock, who actually has a little place on the island, is bringing her stoat dog. So people will see that indeed there are other methods.
A stoat dog. That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder what sort of breed that is.
I think it's a Jack Russell, but I'm not sure. Right. And we have Finn Buchanan, who's from Dock, and he's the famous person who owns Jack, the rat dog. I'm not sure if Jack's coming, but we're trying to have a bit of interest and lead people to think about these issues in the different ways.
And whereabouts is that being
It's going to be at Surfdale Hall, mm-hmm. and we're providing refreshments at the end of the meeting. There'll be a chance for a forum for discussion. We'll have a panel of local experts who will help lead that discussion, what is being done on the island, and we'll be wanting to really ask questions about benefits and costs for people.
Right. Will baits be available, bait stations and baits be available at that
We won't be selling bait stations. There will be a private company there that will have brochures, and we will probably maybe have some of our bait there for people to look at.
Right. And you were saying you sell the bait at the market on the
We
Saturday.
Do sell at our stall at the Ostend Market on Saturday morning. Bait is sold.
That's the Forest and Bird stall.
That's right.
Yeah, right. I was talking to Dane Dixon the other day, and he emailed me some photographs of his property down the bottom end at Awaroa. And he said he was amazed at how the bird life has come back down there, because his bait stations he's put out seem to be working really well. And he's got tuis on it. He's got a bird bath, and there were four tui drinking out of it and having swims and bathing in it, which is great to see it.
It is wonderful to see. And there's no reason why Waiheke couldn't have better bird life. In some of the other islands where they've done pest control in recent years, birds can actually live happily with well-disciplined domestic cats and even some feral cats and even with stoats. They can't live well with rats, especially shipwrights. So we're not going to see more bird life here on Waiheke Island in our reserves and our people's bush residential properties unless we do particularly rat control.
I haven't seen any sign of rats around my property in Rocky Bay for probably a good 6 months, 6 to 7 months. I was putting baits out and that sort of thing. So hopefully we're getting there.
Have you seen more birds, Jan?
Yes, I have. I have. They've been, I've even had a pheasant sort of resided for a wee while on my neighbours. There have been a lot of pheasants around, actually, when you're driving out of the bay in the morning. And the wood pigeons. And the tui, of course, they've been great.
Wouldn't it be good if we saw bellbirds? In your garden.
I was sure I heard one, actually, but I think there might be the odd one on the island, is there?
Well,
didn't they release a few a couple of years ago?
When Mike spoke at the public meeting that he held in Rocky Bay Hall, he said not many people saw them, the ones that released, in the 1980s. No one's reported any recently. But that was before Whakanaefa existed in the way it is now, and before Whakanaefa and the rangers there were pest controlling. And of course they're going to try to have sound anchoring for the bellbirds for a while to see if they'll stay rather than fly off, to Palm Beach like apparently they did last time. Okay. They must have liked the beach.
Well, that's all right. We haven't got anything against Palm Beach. They can go there. Now, how are we going to know when we've beaten the rat problem?
Well, the first thing is we won't have rats in our ceilings as much. People won't hear the little scurrying feet.
But there might be mice.
There might be mice, but I don't. And we won't have as many rat droppings, obviously, around our compost, although the compost rats tend to be more Norway rats and Kiora.
The bush rats.
The bush rats can be ship rats. I think people get confused between the different types of rats.
So
but
what,
then
what
we'll hear, we'll see more little birds, we'll see more fantails, we'll see more white eyes, we'll see more, that sort of bird. And the rats do sort of predate other sorts of creatures as well. Creatures that the birds actually have, some birds have as prey themselves.
The last time I saw a good size rat would have been 2 or 3 years ago, and it was quite a beautiful creature actually. It was a dark brown, glossy coat. What sort of rat would that have been?
It could be a ship rat. Did it have a long, long tail?
Yes.
That was a ship rat.
Okay.
That was a ship rat.
Okay.
The Norway rat has a short, stubby tail.
Oh, okay. I always thought all rats had long tails.
Well, no, the Norway rat has a much shorter tail, but unfortunately the coat of the Norway rat changes, so sometimes it does look brown. So you're really looking for that tail when you're discriminating.
Hmm.
I mean, even me, I don't look very closely at the rats.
And if I can be politically incorrect for a moment, what used to be referred to as a Maori rat, is that would that have been a bush rat or a boat rat or a Norway rat? Or
it's a kiura. It's a different species altogether.
So is that a native rat?
It's a rat that might be even considered a little bit native, only because Maori, it came with Maori in their waka.
Ah, right.
And you can tell kiura because they have funny little stick-up ears, round ears, Mickey Mouse ears, and it's squatter and smaller. The ship rats also have such big ears that they can, when they're frightened, they can bring their ears apparently in front of their eyes.
Oh, that'd be handy.
The ship rats definitely have very big ears, whereas the kiura have short Mickey Mousey type ears.
So the kiura and the Norway rats aren't as dangerous to the wildlife as the ship rat.
They're not such excellent climbers, and the ship rats are very predating of nests and eggs.
That just rung a little bell on my head. When we were having the problems with the doctorals down at Whakanefa, because they nest on the ground, were they ever targeted by rats?
Yes, they would have been. They would also be targeted by the few, I don't know how many stoats we have on the island, but we certainly have stoats.
Mm.
And they may have been targeted by feral cats as well.
Is there any program to try and eradicate the stoats?
I think Whakanefa puts traps out for the stoats, Dock 200s, and we'll be having a range of traps at the workshop to show people, first of all, what they are and how to use them if they want to go for a trapping regime.
Okay.
And the traps are getting better, and there are more types of different traps on the island. Not on the island, but in be able to be purchased. And the stoats are they're very hard to catch. Marsupials, mustelids, rat, stoats, weasels, ferrets. We don't have weasels and ferrets on the island. They're very, very clever and very suspicious. And if you're going to trap for a stoat, you need to use something like a rabbit meat, or you can use a rat. Actually, they go for rats as well.
Kill two of them.
We could kill
time,
two. That's right. There is more effective ways to get at them, but they're the worst. They're the hardest to kill, actually.
Right. So if people suspect they've got rats on the roof or under the house or around their compost bin, then they need to come along to the seminar on the Saturday?
Saturday, the 24th of April, in the afternoon from 1 to 4.
At the Surfdale Hall.
At the Surfdale Hall.
Right. Or go along to the forest and bird stall at the market on a Saturday to get some baits and probably some advice.
Exactly.
That'd be great. Thank you very much, Sue, and good luck with the rat eradication program.
Thank you very much, Dan. Have a good day.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.